Now, we've already heard about how maths can be applied to the world of gambling, but that's probably not that surprising, seeing as gambling is just numbers. But how can a mathematician help when it comes to the more hands-on methods of the surgeon or the forensic scientist? Well, biomechanics is a rapidly growing field, and it's proving that if you need to know how best to conduct surgery, whether a stabbing was intentional or where a brain tumour is, you might just be better off speaking to a mathematician. And here we are, where you've got Professor Michel Destrade in studio. He's the established Professor of Applied Mathematics at NUI Galway. Welcome to the programme, Michel. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, thanks very much. So your work is really interesting because essentially you are trying to find out the best way to cut up a human body.
That's right. That's the type of question a surgeon might ask themselves when they are faced with a procedure. How should they cut it open? Should they cut that way, this way? Does it matter? Turns out it does. That's because our skin is stretched in our body, and it's stretched in different directions at different locations. And depending how you cut compared to those directions, you will end up having either a neat scar or a bumpy, unsightly scar. And most surgeons pay attention to that. They want to make sure you're going to have a neat scar that will heal quickly and as neatly as possible.
Because it's not just cosmetics, is it? The scar that's left. It's not just that it's a small, neat scar as opposed to something that looks like, you know, you've
yes,
been
that
to
matters
Dr.
on the face, say, for instance, or on exposed parts. But it also matters in other location. If you have a huge surgery, a large incision, you want it to heal as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
To avoid the risk of infection.
And bigger scar, because scar tissue is different from unscarred or healthy tissue, isn't that right? The actual structure of it is different, and so it doesn't behave in the same way. So you want a smaller scar because the more healthy tissue you have, the better.
True. And also, it's bumpier and stiffer. And also, if you're still growing, say if you have a surgery when you're young, then if the scar is not well oriented, then it might just spread. Say, for instance, you have a mole removed on your torso, and that skin is thin and will stretch a lot as you grow. That might lead to a really large area of scar tissue.
Okay. So this is not a problem I'd really thought about, you know, what the best way is to cut open a body. And, you know, I'd say most people, besides psychopaths and surgeons, probably haven't really thought about it either. But you have come up with a really interesting way of approaching this problem, because if you cut in the right way, it's a small scar. But if you cut in the wrong direction, it can be a big scar. How do we know which way our skin is going? Because it's different for everyone, isn't it?
Yes. So like I say, it's important to know those directions where the skin is stretched. Because if you are cutting perpendicular to those directions, then the scar will just gape open. And then even if you stitch it back up, there will still be, you know, a tug at the site, and that will require nutrients to come, and that will lead to a bumpy scar. So finding these directions knowing those directions is a big issue for surgeons. So usually they rely on anatomy maps. And if you look in the anatomy books, you will find those lines for men and those lines for women. And that's the only distinction there is. When really it might change from one person to another according to other factors. For instance, your body mass index, your age, your health status, your ethnicity, all sorts of factors will change the orientation of those lines.
Your ethnicity determines the direction of your tissue, really?
The direction of tension in the skin.
Oh, yes. Tension in the skin. Okay.
There are differences.
So give an example of how these things would differ. So
say maybe you become obese or say you are pregnant, your skin is going to be stretched.
Yeah.
And it's likely that the orientation of those lines is going to be different as it was before you were pregnant, for instance.
So to try and figure out the direction of the stretch, you've used sound.
So yes, our point of view is that we could maybe help surgeons make a decision on how to best cut open a body of one person at a given location. And to do that, we use sound waves. So we just launch sound waves in the skin and try to figure out in which direction they go at their fastest.
And so if it travels really fast, that means it's really, really tight?
That was the idea. And you could think of, for instance, say a guitar string that you are making tauter. It will vibrate faster. So that you see that there's a link between how fast something vibrates or moves and how tight it is. And so that was the mathematical hypothesis, was that the sound wave would go at its fastest along the direction of the stretch. But that was just a hypothesis, of course. We had to test it in the lab.
So the idea is you have the side of the scar, and then you've got a sort of a microphone set somewhere near the scar, and then you what, tap the scar?
Basically, yes. It's a very simple device that has two probes, one that taps the skin and another one that picks up the signal a bit further away.
And you stopwatch it and you see if it's really fast.
You know the distance between the two probes, and then you know how fast the sound travels.
Okay. So how did you test this? Because presumably you can't just do this on people. It'd be slightly unethical to start working on people's scars and just prodding them with probes. How did you go about
it? Well, the probe is non-invasive. I just put it on your skin. So we did it on ourselves. So we gave ourselves ethical approval, I guess. Huh. But like I was saying, there's this hypothesis that the wave will travel, the sound will travel at its fastest. And to test it, we used dead animals that we obtained from the UCD School of Veterinary Science. We found the direction of fastest sound. And then at that site, we cut out a circle of skin, a disc, perfect disc. And then we watched as the disc started elongating, because remember that the skin is stretched. So the circle is going to turn into an ellipse. And sure enough, the ellipse was aligned with that direction we'd found. So that was the proof of concept, that the sound device was telling you the direction of stretch in the skin at the given spot.
Okay, so there is huge, obviously, medical applications for this. Are there other applications that I haven't thought of for this, knowing where the tension is in a body?
Yes, we're also hoping to be able to determine the level of tension, saying the skin is under so much force at this spot or at another spot. And that's very important for surgeons who do reconstructive surgery. They want to know maybe if they're going to graft something or they're going to expand your skin in another location so then they can graft it into the site where they want to suture it in. And they want to know what is the level of tension there.
Right.
Because it might, if there's too much of a differential, it might be that the graft is going to rupture, for instance. So they want to make sure that the graft they're putting is the right shape and is not going to rupture once they put it in that site.
There's probably an application for this. I mean, I was joking about psychopaths earlier, but presumably in crime, there's an application for knowing what happens when you cut a body and how it affects the body. Would that be useful helping criminal cases?
In fact, that's how I got interested in the mechanics of the skin in the first place, is that the first project was about forensics. We were approached by Professor Mary Cassidy and Dr. Mike Curtis from the State Pathologist's Office. And at the time, I was in UCD's School of Mechanical Engineering, and they were asking us, can you help us determine the level of force that's required to puncture the skin, the human skin?
They didn't know that?
It's not known, no. It's not known in a scientific way. They often ask that question at trials, right?
Right.
They ask, well, what was the level of force? Because the defendant would say, oh, it was a running scenario.
He walked into me, knife.
Exactly.
Mate.
Wanted to give him a hug and he fell onto the knife
and fell and stabbed himself five times. Yeah.
So then the judge turns to the forensic expert and says, is that possible? Can a knife just go through? And what was the level of force used in this assault? And they have to give terms that make sense to them, but might be a bit vague to a jury. Terms like mild or moderate or severe. That's the only type of description they can give.
Right, okay.
So moderate to you might go, oh, maybe that's
not
much.
Not so bad.
Yes, but maybe it involves...
I wouldn't mind being moderately stabbed.
Exactly, but maybe it involves having to go through cartilage and, breaking a bone on the way. So they're very frustrated by this level of uncertainty.
Okay, so the state pathologist came to you to kind of say, look, we want to know what level of force is required to puncture the skin. Is it possible that someone just brushed into someone and stabbed them, or would they have actually have to direct it? And you found a metric for that, did you?
So we started up a PhD project. So I was working with Professor Michael Gilchrist in UCD, and we recruited Ashley Niani, a brilliant student who managed to do experiments first on pig skin and then also on human skin in France, trying to determine the level of force it takes to puncture a human skin.
And is it a lot or?
Turns out it's pretty low. If you're talking about just naked skin, it doesn't take that much force.
Really?
Say 10 to 20 newtons. So that would be the equivalent of 1 kilo or 2 kilos of sugar put on your skin.
Oh, wow.
Of course,
is that all?
But that's for a pointy knife.
And
a given knife. Okay. If it's a screwdriver, maybe it takes 30 to 50.
How does anyone ever get a conviction with all these things? So That's really interesting, but you've sort of applied this mathematical idea, kind of taking maths and looking at biomechanics and so on, to lots of different problems. And one of them was looking at the structure of the brain and again, trying to find a tumor in the brain. Can you tell us a bit about that sort of research?
Yes. The main question I wanted to answer is, how soft in the head are we, really? Because it's an expression I understood really quickly when I learned English.
Right.
When people say, oh, he's a bit soft in the head, you know what they mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was wondering, how soft in
the
head?
Did they have that in French?
No, we don't have that.
No.
But it's easy to understand for a foreigner.
Yeah, yeah.
But the truth is, how soft is brain matter? What do you think, Jonathan? Rubber?
No, it's got to be like jelly, right? It's very soft and good. I've held a brain.
Although
it seems
brain,
quite,
yes.
It seems, maybe that's just because it's slimy on the outside, but it does feel sort of soft.
It is soft.
Is it very soft?
It is very soft, yes.
Okay.
In the end, we use the same principle. We launch sound waves through the brain and we watch them travel through an ultrasound image and measure their speed. And then we did the same for gelatin. So it was a 5% gelatin solution. 5% gelatin, 95% water. So it's one of the softest things I can think of. And still, the speed was slower in the brain than in the gelatin,
wow.
Indicating that the brain was softer than the gelatin.
So if I didn't have a skull, you could just push your finger straight through.
Yeah. Well, there's the meningites, the dura mater, so membrane, and then there's the skull.
So the membrane is like a little plastic bag or whatever.
Yes,
so
and that's very tough.
Is it?
Very hard to cut and to penetrate.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And it holds your brain. But say you were in an impact, or you had a repeated injury, or maybe you were exposed to a blast explosion, then there could be movement inside the envelope.
Okay.
And that's bad news. It could be that your neurons, your axons, you know, those channels of information in your brain, they get stretched and that they might even break. And then that's traumatic brain injury.
Does, because you were talking about brain injuries and I was thinking there about tumors. Do tumors, are they the same? Do they change the actual tissue?
That's also something very interesting. Once I was talking to a neurosurgeon in the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, asking him, how does he know which is the diseased tissue as opposed to the healthy tissue when he's faced with a brain that he wants to operate on, right? So typically, if you have a tumor in your brain, they just do a trepanation, they take out a piece of your skull, they cut out the dura mater, they expose the brain, and they know the tumor is in this area, but where is it exactly? And I was asking him,
You're saying when someone does a brain operation,
surgery operation,
they know the tumor is in sort of an area? Can they not map it?
So they know exactly where it is from an MRI scan.
Okay.
And so now for the operation, they put you in a device that will just recreate exactly locate exactly where the tumor is. So then the surgeon is going to remove a part of the skull above that area. But what happens then when you take out a part of the skull, the brain shifts a little bit. That's what they call it, brain shifts. It sort of expands a little bit because it was a bit compressed in your skull.
Okay.
And then the contours are a bit off now compared to what you had in your picture.
Oh, no way.
You can't do an MRI anymore because you're operating.
Yeah.
An MRI is long acquisition time.
Yeah.
So I say, well, how do you do it then? Because somehow I thought maybe the tumor looks different. Maybe it's, you know, black and the rest is white.
No.
But you say, no, it looks exactly the same.
Huh?
Yes.
So how do they do it?
And they say, oh, you just poke at it. We just use our finger. Well, they have gloves on, right? But they use their finger. They do palpation. I don't want to trivialize it. Palpation is a proper
diagnosis
tool. But that's what they do. They just use their fingers to figure out which part is stiff and they know that's the tumor as opposed to which part is soft and they know that's healthy tissue.
And then they
stop there.
So they just, what, they just tap and suck?
To remove a tumor, brain is so soft that naively, I thought they were using scalpels maybe, but no, it's so soft that they actually use a sort of aspiration pipette, slurping device.
Like a dentist's sucker.
Exactly, yes. And
oh,
just suck out cells like this. And another doctor I was talking to, Nick DePennington, he told me that he listens to the sound of this slurping device. And he knows that if the pitch changes, he knows that he's hitting the healthy part and it stops. So,
what do you mean? Like he's going, and if it goes,
yes,
that's healthy tissue. You're kidding.
So it's pretty crude tools, right? Either palpation or either listening to the...
God.
But that's the top of neurosurgery at the moment for cancerous brain tumors.
So we were just talking about how you were using sort of sound yes. to determine the nature of the brain. Could surgeons use sound to figure out where the
hopefully
where the tumor is? Is there? I mean, I know you have a device for testing the scar yes. direction, the tissue direction. Can you do that for a brain? Because it sounds like they would really need that. I mean, it sounds important, right?
There exist already a medical device that propagates sound waves in soft tissues. It's only a few years old. It's used mostly for breast cancer or for liver, for instance. But I'm hoping to use it on the human brain. And I'm hoping that it will catch this difference in stiffness and put a number on how stiff the tumor is as opposed to a healthy tissue. That's what I'm hoping to do. As you can imagine, it's going to be difficult and it's going to require a lot of ethical approval and approaching neurosurgeons to do this.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to be able to give them a number in the end and say, this is not good and this is healthy.
Because it all comes down to a number. So that number is the distance or the time it takes, and that number will tell you
yes.
this is healthy tissue or this is not healthy tissue and this is where yes, you cut.
So because it's linked to stiffness. And so in the end, I'd be able to put the number of what they're feeling with their fingers or what they're hearing in the change of pitch. I'd be able to quantify this.
And hopefully. With the number, you can create a tool like a beeping noise that when
something
they get...
Yeah, would yeah, something would be more accurate, I guess.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff. Professor Michel d'Estrade, established professor of applied mathematics at NUI Galway. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay.